Our guest on The Year That Made Me today is a member of the Australian Aviation Hall of Fame and a pioneer of world aviation. Captain Deborah Laurie brought the first sex discrimination case ever heard by Victoria's Equal Opportunity Board. Her case went all the way to the High Court, where she won. Deborah became the first female pilot for a major airline in Australia and went on to become the longest flying female airline pilot in the world. Now, Captain Deborah Laurie has released her memoir, Touching the Sky. Deborah, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thanks, Julian.
Now, I feel like this segment was made for you, Deborah, because 1979 was an absolute bumper year for you. So many things happening. Could we begin by hearing how it was that on the 31st of January 1979, you were the one at the centre of this first contested sex discrimination case in the Equal Opportunity Board of Victoria?
Right. Well, that was when the case was heard for the first time, but there was a lot of preparation done before that. During the previous year, I had been for an interview with ANSET, and that had occurred after several years of applying to ANSET and being just kind of basically put off till I thought I would get to 27 years of age, which was the cut-off limit for employment in the pilot trainee program. So eventually I went through their interviewing process, and at the end of that, after getting good results, which I was aware of, I was sent a letter to say that I was not accepted and best of luck with the rest of my career, whatever that might be. And we were suspicious, or I was suspicious, that this was because I was a female. So we ended up going to the Commissioner for Equal Opportunity and spoke with her, and she subsequently spoke with ANSET to check out these allegations. And after her conversation with him, she was left in no doubt that there was a case to answer.
That's Reg ANSET, who was the founder of ANSET, and it's pretty fair to say that he made his rationale pretty clear.
Yes. He was, you know, women weren't strong enough. They were going to panic once a month, or panic all the time, according to him. And basically, he said it was for reasons of safety that he didn't want any women to ever be on his flight decks. So the whole preparation of that was done through 1978. And towards the end of that year, things really got going, because the hearing was due for 31st of January the following year. So that's how that all came about.
And I suppose implied in that is two things. One, that you'd caught the bug for flying, and also that you didn't mind having a bit of a fight about issues of gender discrimination. Could you tell us what was in your past that sort of seeded those two things?
Well, my grandfather on my mother's side was a very prominent or well-known politician in Sydney. He was in the Federal Labor Party.
This is Eddie Ward.
Eddie Ward, yes. He was Minister for Transport and External Territories, and he had the seat of East Sydney for, I think, a record number of years. But he was well known for fighting for his beliefs in Parliament and often getting into trouble for that. Very, you know, competitive man, very stubborn, and a lot of his values rubbed off on me as I was growing up. He died when I was 10. But I was lucky enough to have been influenced by him for several years.
And what about flying? When did that come into your life, and what sort of impact did it make on you?
Flying didn't come in till a little bit later, when I was 14. My father wanted to learn to fly. It was a lifelong ambition for him. And he was in a position to be able to take flying lessons. And I got involved with all the study, the theory books with him, and helped him with checklists and learning all that sort of stuff, and became really interested myself. And as the eldest child, I was quite close to him, and I used to go to Moorabbin Airport when he had his lessons, and eventually I was allowed to go up in the aeroplane and sit in the back. And then one day the instructor turned around and said, "How about you learn to fly?" And I thought, well, that sounds like a challenge. So I started. Dad gave me two lessons for my 16th birthday, and that's when I started.
To start flying is one thing. To then conceive of it as a career for a young woman at that time was quite another thing. How did that shape up in your mind?
Well, it didn't shape up in my mind immediately. There's a long road to go before you get to an airline or being able to apply to an airline. So I had to get my various licenses, a private license and a commercial license. I got an instructor's rating and what they call an instrument rating. And I used to do lots of safaris around Australia and carted opals from the outback back to Melbourne for a friend of my father. And gradually when I was getting all these more and more hours up, you start to get to the point where you can apply to become an airline pilot trainee. And as I progressed along that path, that was where I saw my future. And I was told in no uncertain terms by all the guys around me not to bother because I was way ahead of my time and that airlines would never take women in the foreseeable future. But I chose to ignore that those people and went plowed forward anyway.
We're speaking with Captain Deborah Laurie on The Year That Made Me, and 1979 was a momentous year for her and really for women in aviation and far beyond as well because of the sex discrimination case that Deborah brought during that year. You've mentioned your grandfather, Deborah, but 1979 also began with a very sad moment, the loss of your grandmother. Could you speak a little bit about her and the role she had in encouraging you to take on things like flying and fighting for the right to fly?
Yeah, my grandmother, Edith Ward, she died just before I was due to go to that first board.
Just a few weeks before.
Just a few weeks before, yeah, which was really tragic. And she was my number one fan and she'd been collecting all the newspaper clippings and following my progress really, really closely. And I have to say this about both my grandparents, where they're a great believer in education and they're a great believer in encouraging you no matter what you wanted to do. So she was intrigued by this flying business and loved to hear all my stories. And so it was very sad for me that she didn't get to see me achieve my final goal.
Yes, and that was the result of these legal proceedings throughout 1979. One of the things about it, I introduced you as Captain Deborah Laurie, the famous case is Ansett versus Wardley, and that in itself relates to another huge moment in 1979. Deborah, could you tell us about that?
Yeah, that 10th of February I got married to Peter Wardley, and that was, of course, a big event. But it happened right in the middle of this court case because the first Equal Opportunity Board hearing was disqualified because they didn't follow the proper legal procedure. So a new board had to be formed to hear the whole case all over again. And in that period in between, I had a wedding.
I mean, organising a wedding is stressful enough, let alone happening at the same time as a landmark legal case.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The first day I appeared in the second hearing, I was asked which name I wanted to proceed under. And it caught me off guard on the spot. And I just said, Wardley, because I was now married. So that's why it became Wardley versus Ansett.
And even on your wedding day, Deborah, you were still captivated by flight. What else happened on your wedding day?
Well, I was a bit naughty, actually, because we had Women Pilots Association had an annual air race, which was called the Freda Thompson Aerial Derby, and it was around Port Phillip Bay. It was like a flat chat, a bit like a older version of the Red Bull type of air. And I always went in it, and I was always trying to win it, and it just happened to be on the same day as my wedding. So I did that air race in the morning and raced home and got ready just in time. But it was a bit naughty, actually. But
and as well as providing legal services, I believe your solicitor also helped with the wedding dress.
She did. Yeah, she made my wedding dress.
It must have been very grueling, though, to go through these cases throughout 1979. And it wasn't just one case. You got all the way to the High Court within the stretch of the year. Could you talk us through how you felt going through each stage of those hearings, and in particular hearing how just straight out sexist the case that being put against your career by Ansett was.
Yeah, well, it was very difficult. Right at the beginning, Ansett applied to be exempted from this law altogether. And that was at the end of 1978. And they failed in that attempt. So that was painfully obvious that they didn't want to be bound by this particular law. So when the second board hearing ruled in my favour that I was to be employed in the next pilot intake for Ansett, of course, they appealed that decision. That went to the Supreme Court, I think it was two times. And what Ansett kept doing was finding different arguments. Each time one argument failed, they'd come up with something else. And one of the most disturbing ones was an outright fabrication of what I'd said in the interview process. They claimed that I was going to go off and have three or four children and that this was going to incur incredible cost to them and that that wasn't fair. And of course, that was not true. And all these sorts of things were going on in the background. Eventually, they came up with the idea that because a pilot has to be a member of the Pilots Union, which is a federal award, and that federal award states that you can be dismissed for any reason in the first 12 months of your employment, that the federal law overrules state law. So the state law was saying you can't discriminate, but the pilots agreement was saying you could be dismissed for any reason, even being female was good enough for a reason. Ansett decided to rely on that principle. And because the Supreme Court system couldn't deal with that, it was handballed to the High Court.
Mm. Well, as if an equal opportunity board or a Supreme Court isn't intimidating enough, then all of a sudden you find yourself in the High Court of Australia, and that was an all-male bench.
Yeah.
All-male barristers as well, I believe, in the case.
Yeah, there were six judges on the bench. There were several silks from various states around Australia who were all there in the interest of their own equal opportunity laws. Because if Ansett won this case, it would have meant that the equal opportunity law didn't have any teeth. And that would mean that it could be challenged and knocked over in, you know, in Tasmania and South Australia. So all these legal people were present. The courtroom was absolutely full of guys in silks and wigs and stuff. There were a few women there. Ansett had an entourage, I think, of about nearly 10 legal people. And of course, I still had my only John Dwyer, who had been by my side the whole time.
Both inside the court and outside as well, with all the media attention, it must have been very stressful for you. What was it like to be at the centre of that media storm?
Oh, the media storm was very, very stressful, especially every time Ansett announced an appeal and it was obvious that they were trying to run me out of money and, you know, all that sort of thing. But by the time it got to the High Court, it was out of my hands and I could just sit back there and the High Court was actually quite entertaining because they went in with a certain level of arrogance and they hadn't done their homework properly on a couple of matters. And Justice Murphy interjected during their presentation several times and basically caused a lot of embarrassment for their legal team. Yeah, it was great.
Did you come away from the High Court hearing optimistic that you'd be successful?
My barrister was optimistic and I just had to go on, you know, his feeling. I was cautious about being as optimistic as he was. But because I was still under the orders of the Equal Opportunity Board, Ansett couldn't put off their training anymore. And they had an intake on the 5th of November of that year, which I was put on. So I actually started ground school on the 5th of November, which was 2 days or something after the High Court hearing.
Yeah.
And I had to do that training knowing any minute the High Court may hand down a decision that would give Ansett the right to fire me. So it was very weird.
Mm. What sort of reception did you get when you turned up to undertake that induction and flight training for Ansett?
Right. Well, with the pilot training in those days, you do 6 weeks or so of ground school, so classroom teaching. And the ground instructors were all very, very supportive of me. So the workers within ANSET were very, very supportive. Everyone was watching every single move I made. I think people were waiting, you know, watching if I would make a mistake or whatever. So I had to study very, very hard, you know, to prove that I deserved to be there. But they were very, very helpful because during that first week of my ground school, ANSET decided that they would try to use an event that had happened at Moorabbin the year before, which was basically a near-miss event in the circuit area for which I was not at fault, that the other aircraft was actually at fault. However, they decided they would use that to try and prove that I was unsafe. And so they tried to eject me out of the ground school as well. And that's when the pilots' union stepped in and came to my defence. So that was all happening in 1979 as well.
So when did you actually achieve that dream of becoming a pilot on a commercial airline in Australia?
Well, interestingly, in December of 1979, Rupert Murdoch became the major shareholder in ANSET Transport Industries, and Reg ANSET lost his power base, if you like. And I had taught Rupert Murdoch's brother-in-law how to fly. So when I got wind of the fact that they were really desperately trying everything to get rid of me, apparently the order was, let her do the ground school, but she will never step in an aircraft. When I got wind of that instruction from Reg ANSET, I actually made a phone call to Rupert's brother-in-law and I said, I've got a bit of a problem. And he said, well, look, let me have a chat to Rupert and we'll see what we can do. And Rupert Murdoch issued a memo the following Tuesday, I think it was, to say that I was to be treated exactly the same as all my other male colleagues. And from that point on, that's when I went on to actually get on an aircraft and learn to fly the F-27.
Tell us about your first passenger trip, Deborah.
That was in January, the 1980. But I had to fly as a passenger up to Alice Springs. And then I was meeting my training captain in Alice Springs and we were going to fly up what they called the milk run up to Darwin. And I thought I was finally free of all the press and all the kerfuffle and everything. And when I arrived in Alice Springs, the press were waiting there. So I just went, oh my God. Anyway, my training captain was very lovely. He was very, very supportive. And he said, just go out and do whatever you have to do with the press and then we can get going. And like everything, they want you to pose this way and that way and lean on this and lean on that. And they got me leaning on the strut of the left main gear. And as I did it, I realized I now had a huge oil slick all the way down my arm. So, you know, I was like, oh, the last thing, you know, when you're turning up for your first training flight, now I'm in this state with oil all over me. Well, the training captain thought that was hilarious. So after that, I cleaned all that up. We got on our way and, it was a great day. It was a really good day.
Who was your first passenger on an early trip to Canberra?
My mother. My poor mother. This was, of course, was not an airline trip. This was just after I got my private license. It was my first cross-country trip ever. And she needed to go to an engagement party or something in Canberra. And I had the brilliant idea that I would fly her there. And she was sort of like, you sure? And yeah, of course I'm sure, you know, I know how to do this. So anyways, we set off and as luck would have it, the weather started turning pretty bad as we approached Canberra. And in those days, there was no GPS or anything like that. You had to navigate by maps and calculations and so on. And I was not sure of where we were. And as we were approaching the Canberra control zone, I wasn't really sure where we were. And my mother is looking at me and going, what's wrong with you? And I said, I'm telling her to just be quiet because I'm concentrating. Anyway, she'd spent many, many years in Canberra, so she knew the area very well. And she started saying to me, well, that's Lake George over there. And and that's such and such, and this is such and such. And I'm going, well, how do you know all this? And I was just absolutely mortified. But because of her, we actually did establish where we were. And then it was all okay after that.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Captain Deborah Laurie, who's released a memoir about her extraordinary life in the skies. It's called Touching the Sky. We've spoken about one passenger there, Deborah. What about when you actually had commercial airline passengers as a pilot? What sort of reception did you get from both the passengers and also the other staff?
The passengers, I have to say, in my entire career, I've never had a passenger get off because I'm up there, up the front. Some of them might have bitterly complained about women being up the front and how bad, wrong is that and all this sort of stuff. But also some were really great. You know, they used to send the boarding passes up for me to autograph. So, you know, there was a real mixed type of reception there. But the cabin crew were amazing. They were so proud of me and so supportive, and they wouldn't hear of anyone speaking ill against me. You know, they were very defensive. They were fantastic.
What about the other pilots?
That was a mixture. So in an airline, when you start out, you're in the junior ranks, but you're also with the junior captains. The senior captains are up on the bigger aircraft and have been there for longer. And the junior captains were no problem at all. Most of them were really lovely, but there were some of the senior guys and some of the other guys as well who were just really, really obnoxious and horrible and tried to make me feel as uncomfortable as possible and made my life at times very, very difficult. But I stuck in there, and they had an event every year where they used to honour the people who retired, and this was an all-male affair, and it was organised by the flight engineers. There were no women allowed to these events at all. No wives, no girlfriends or anything like that. And the reason was because they all needed to tell their old war stories, and sometimes that meant the wife might have got upset or the girlfriend might have got upset or whatever. So after I'd been flying for 4 years, the flight engineers came along to me and said, we're going to invite you. And I went, well, that's an honour. And they said, well, you're really one of the boys, you know, you're one of us. So you're invited. I think that was the sign that I was accepted finally.
So you got personal acceptance. Over the course of your career, how much has changed in terms of accessibility for women who want to be commercial airline pilots?
Well, a lot has changed. I mean, these days there's no barriers to entry at all for women. In fact, they try to encourage women because they're trying to increase their female percentage. And also airlines, companies have made it a lot easier for women to work in this job, because it's not easy doing this type of job and raising a family at the same time. So they've come good with maternity leave and all sorts of other things to help women work around the family aspect of their life as well. So it's a completely different world to the one in which I went into.
And all that really was made possible by your pioneering flying and legal cases. Deborah, there have been many accolades that you've received over the years. Member of the Order of Australia in 2019, inducted into the Australian Aviation Hall of Fame. But there was one honour which I think has a particularly beautiful irony to it. In November of 2023, Sydney Airport named the Deborah Laurie Flyover in your honour. What did that feel like? And could you tell us what it flies over?
Yeah, well, it's the last bit of the connection from the Sydney International into the domestic airport. And I'd been walking to work quite often and watching the last bits of construction of this thing as it was being finished, and quite fascinated by it because it's really lovely because it swoops around and sort of descends into the airport, if you like. And one day I got a phone call from Sydney Airport that they had been given the naming rights of this particular flyover, and they had decided to name it after me because there was nothing on the airport named after any women at all. And I thought it was a joke at first. I thought someone was pulling my leg. So I was very, very excited about this. The next day I walked to work, I had to go 10 minutes earlier to take lots of photos of it. But what tickled their fancy and also mine, of course, is that it actually swoops in over the top of Sir Reginald Ansett Drive, which is the side street on the airport. So
so now the Deborah Lorry flyover goes right over the drive named after the man who tried to stop you from getting that job. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's terrific.
Deborah, you wrote that writing the book, writing the memoir, Touching the Sky, was very challenging and thought-provoking for you.
Mm.
What were you referring to there?
Oh, look, I think I've been flying for many, many, many years, and people have said to me over the years, you know, you need to write a book. You need to write a book because you've got so many stories. And I think the challenging thing was to get it down to the size of a book to start with, but also just revisiting the whole of my career was just quite amazing, just to think back on just all the twists and turns that it's had and ups and downs and challenges along the way. That was the, you know, thought-provoking side of it.
There's also a beautifully touching forward to the book from, quote, your son and fellow pilot, Tom.
Yes.
What was it like to read that forward?
Oh, well, of course, I didn't have any dry eyes when I read that. I just thought, how you never know what your kids think about you, but this was just the most amazing piece of what he wrote, and it just touched me so much. But the interesting thing too is that when other people read it, they had the same reaction, that they teared up when they read this. So, yeah, it's a beautiful thing. And he grew up saying, oh, you know, Mum, your job's stupid and, you know, all this type of stuff, because I was, you know, wasn't like other mums. I wasn't there all the time. And he got a bit resentful of that. But when he came with me on one flight when he was sitting on the jump seat, and we happened to be flying over Iraq at the time, and Tom was busy eating his business class meal as a 15-year-old tucking in there. And I just said to him, you know, that's Baghdad down there. It was nighttime and you could see the lights of Baghdad. And he just put down his knife and fork. And he couldn't believe, because it had been in the news with the Iraqi war, he couldn't believe that he was looking at this place that had been in the news and all that sort of stuff. So he just announced to me, he said, Mum, your job's pretty cool. And I think that was when Tom's interest in flying sparked.
Yeah, he clearly caught the bug too. And he writes in that beautiful forward, to many others, she's a pioneer. Now that I'm a father to a daughter, I'm grateful for that and will be forever. Deborah Lorry, it's been fantastic speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thanks, Julian. Thank you very much.
And we always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us, Deborah, and why?
Well, I looked at the 1979 top hit list, and I have to say there's a lot of really good ones. So it was a difficult choice, but Billy Joel's My Life has always resonated a bit with me, and it's upbeat and it's positive and, you know, it's like a go-getter thing. So I chose that.
Well, there really couldn't be any more appropriate song than Billy Joel's My Life. And Captain Deborah Lorry, thank you once again.
Thanks, Julian. Thank you.
That's Captain Deborah Lorry. Her memoir is Touching the Sky. And as her son writes, if you've ever doubted yourself, if you feel like no one understands what challenges you're facing or your dreams are bigger than what is currently perceived as possible, then this book is for you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.